Ladies and gentlemen, as President of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon for the 7th Robert Strauss Huppe Lecture. It is hard to believe that he is not with us. He passed away 2.5 years ago, a month short of his 99th birthday, and I can tell you that he was very acute up to the very end. He lived long enough to see our triumph in the Cold War, to see the end of the post-Cold War era and the beginning of the war against terrorism. Thankfully, he did not live to witness the behavior of the Western Alliance under these circumstances, because that was something that was very dear to his heart. I'd like to say a word or two about Strauss Huppe's attitude towards alliances in general and the Western Alliance in particular. He was too much of the historian and the diplomat not to know that alliances are instrumental and not sacred. They are machinery, things to be used, and if they don't work, to be discarded. But if anything could approach the sacred in the way of an alliance for Robert Strauss Huppe, it was the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. This was because it embodied for him the nascent confederation or even federation of the United States and the Europeans. And he was certain that if these groups could stick together, no matter how many states they were, then there would be a preponderance of power making for peace in the world. He was extremely proud of NATO and his embassy to NATO, and he was also proud of his last embassy, 8 years in Turkey. Turkey symbolized for him that NATO was not strictly a European club, and of course he, as well as any other person who grew up before 1914, the idea that Turkey was not part of the European balance of power was of course laughable. And so the debate today over whether Turkey belongs or doesn't belong, which struck him as really rather peculiar. At first he thought that there could be a united Europe with a vestigial transatlantic relationship, but during the 1950s, under the impact of what he regarded as dithering by the British and obstruction by the French, and of course the idea of the Germans doing this was out of the question, he concluded that the Europeans, left to themselves, would never come together in any kind of a useful federation. And so he came to believe that NATO was absolutely necessary for both Europe and the United States in order to assure peace. For him, the European Union was a, as he used to say, a very powerful stomach muscle, but not much more than that. And when the Balkans troubles began in the 1990s, he used to say that in 1914, the Balkans proved that the balance of power in Europe was not proof against stupidity. And in 1992, the Balkans proved that the European Union was no substitute for willpower. And so, to the very end of his life, he believed and always asserted that the management of the Western Alliance was a key tool for the security of the United States, the Europeans, and indeed for the ideals that they shared in common. I am sure, too, that he would be delighted with our speaker for the evening. Dr. Dov Zakheim has just the sort of credentials that Strauss Huppe always admired, and I'll just read a couple of them to you, and that will suffice to get us on the way. Dr. Zakheim was most recently Undersecretary of Defense from 2001 to 2004. He was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense from 1985 and 87, currently Vice President of Booz Allen Hamilton, and most important of all, a newly re-elected trustee of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Dr. Zakheim has had a long and varied career in both the business world and the government. He's a 1970 graduate of Columbia University, studied at the London School of Economics, and earned his doctorate in economics and politics in St. Anthony's College of the University of Oxford. Amongst his other publications is a book that I still commend to you if you can find it, The Flight of Lavie Inside the U.S.-Israeli Crisis. That will tell you a great deal, probably more than you wanted to know, about the way the United States government does its business. Congress and national security in the post-Cold War era and toward a fortress Europe from the year 2000, and he's a very prolific author and commentator. So we're delighted to have today Dr. Zoe Zackheim to deliver the Robert Strauss Pay Lecture on alliances.
Thanks very much, Harvey. I normally don't use notes, but this is a lecture in memory of somebody whom I respected very, very much. And Robert was very careful about things. I think he would have wanted me to have been careful about exactly what I said, particularly on a subject such as this one. I got to know Robert when he was relatively young. He was a 70-ish-year-old ambassador to Turkey. And I first went out there in 1981, and Turkey was then under military rule. So Robert did not have an easy job explaining Turkey to the United States, or for that matter, the United States to Turkey. But he did it well, as he did everything well. And he did it with this streak of humanity that Harvey alluded to, this wry sense of what makes the world go round, that stood him. You can't hear me. Well, is the microphone on? Can you hear me now? Can anyone not hear me? Maybe you don't want to hear me. As I was saying, Robert had a very wry sense of things, and I think it stood him in tremendous stead. And he, having served in many, many diplomatic posts, really won universal respect, and I felt very privileged to get to know him. As Harvey said, alliances, I have to say a word or two about Harvey. Having left the government, Harvey asked me if I wanted to come back to FPRI, and it didn't take me very long to say yes. I've been pulled to and fro with boards and requests and this and that, but I have a very soft spot for FPRI. I think it plays a very important role in a number of respects. First of all, it's here, which means it's not in Washington or New York, which means there's a message to the rest of the East Coast that there are more than two cities on the East Coast, which is very important. Secondly, under Harvey's leadership, FPRI has become a true intellectual powerhouse, and its ideas, its seminars, what you get in the email, are the stuff of not just policy, but of good policy. So it really felt good to be asked back and to be associated with this institution. Now, of course, Robert was associated with this institution from its inception, as he was with the notion of alliances. And so I will read, pretty much read. I have trouble reading speeches. They tend to bore people. But I will walk through what for me is what makes alliances tick. Now, the state of our alliances today, it is in fact very much in the news. It's become a major campaign issue. When you think about it, that already is something. That a campaign should be built around whether our alliances are in good health or in poor health. But Senator Kerry has asserted virtually throughout his campaign that our prestige abroad is at low ebb, and frankly that our alliances are in tatters. And he points to the reluctance of many of our allies to support the launching of our operation in Iraq, which, as you know, is formally termed Operation Iraqi Freedom, and the reluctance of many more countries, many more allies, to send troops or any kinds of forms of assistance to Iraq. Now, as with most allegations that surface in the course of the campaign, there's a kernel of truth, some bit of truth to this, but frankly, it's not much more than a kernel. America clearly finds itself at loggerheads with some of our allies, especially those who speak French and have Paris as their capital, to the point that many of our opinion leaders no longer consider the French to be an ally. The difficulties with Germany seem to have receded of late, but still, the relationship between Washington and Berlin is not one of hearty conviviality. We're about to launch into Oktoberfest, but that kind of attitude doesn't mark the relationship that we've had with our closest and most powerful continental allies since World War II. We haven't even mended fences with a real treaty ally like Chile, which was reluctant not only to provide any assistance, and I went down to Chile and asked on virtual bended knee for assistance, but wouldn't even support us in the United Nations. If you look at many of our Arab allies, few of them, and many of them, by the way, are now classed as major non-NATO allies, few of them have offered to deploy troops to Iraq, although frankly it's not clear the Iraqis want them. And then if you look at a country like Spain, it's withdrawn troops. Three of our Central American allies, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the Dominican Republic, form part of the Status Brigade, and they've also withdrawn troops. So there's no doubt that at least with respect to Iraq, our alliance relationships are being sorely tested. And there are tensions that go beyond Iraq. A good example is tension with South Korea over just how to deal with the North Korean nuclear threat. So does that mean Senator Kerry is correct? Have we really made such a hash of our alliances? Or worse, is there some kind of secular trend away from alliances? Is this concept some thing of the past, the 20th century thing? Or as my kids would tell me, oh, Dad, an 80s thing. Maybe we're moving away from formal alliances like NATO, as some analysts do allege. It seems to me that the fact that we're debating how to maintain our alliances, and that's really what the debate between Kerry and the President is about, as opposed to how to avoid the alliances, is a sign that at bottom, the state of our international relations is fundamentally sound. The only people who really want to go back full circle to Washington's notion of avoiding entangling alliances are extremists of the right or of the left. Mainstream America isn't interested in that. It's interested in a healthy alliance system. And given that interest, and given the fundamental attractiveness of American political, military, and social power, there can be really very little doubt that we'll be able to call on many allies in any future times of need. And that's not to say we're going to expect every time to have the same roster of allies for every single contingency. In a recent op-ed piece, appeared last Friday, Charles Krauthammer asked, and I'm quoting Charlie here, "Of all our allies in the world, which is the only one to have joined the United States in the foxhole in every war in the past 100 years? Not Britain, not Canada, and then Charlie being Charlie, he writes, certainly not France." And he says, the answer is Australia. Well, the truth of the matter is Charlie's wrong, and that's not a common occurrence. Australia has not been with us in every single foxhole. It wasn't with us in Beirut in the 50s. It wasn't with us in Beirut in the 80s. They weren't with us when we fought in Haiti, and we've been frequent visitors to Haiti over the years, as you know. They weren't with us in Grenada. They weren't with us in Panama. Now, it's true that Haiti, Grenada, Panama, all are part of this hemisphere, but other allies did participate in these operations, or at least in their aftermath. Just to give one example, when we went into Grenada, we had Jamaica, Barbados, and four smaller countries from the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States. They were all participants, and as a former boss of mine, Caspar Weinberger, said, recalled in his memoirs, the contingents were small, but those elements were indeed part of the force. In other words, they got shot at too. But not only these countries, perish the thought that the French, yes, the French, have sent forces to Haiti. That doesn't mean they're overturning the Monroe Doctrine, though I suppose some people in the Cadre say we'd like to. But the fact is that the French were there and the Aussies weren't. Now, I don't want to knock the Australians. They really are as true an ally as we could hope for. Although even the Aussies might reverse themselves if Labour's Mark Latham becomes the next Prime Minister of the country. All I want to point out here is that the roster of our allies is constantly changing. And that's nothing new. recall that Italy was our ally in World War I. Certainly was not our ally in World War II. And then again became our ally toward the end of that war throughout the Cold War. In fact, our contingency planners were planning operations against the United Kingdom. Tony Blair would be shocked. As late as the early 1900s. And in fact, Britain's blockade of Germany in the early years of World War I was a real source of friction to the neutral United States. And our tensions with Britain didn't dissipate after World War I, or for that matter, after World War II. We disagreed with the Brits over Palestine. We clashed bitterly with London and Paris over Suez. And we sorely tested our ties over Vietnam. A lot of folks forget that a significant portion, if not a majority, of the British public, and I lived in Britain at the time, was as resentful of Harold Wilson's support of the war, which in any event, his support was often lukewarm, Harold Wilson being Harold Wilson, if you know anything about his politics, as it is today over Tony Blair's policies. There's nothing new in that. In fact, even Margaret Thatcher, the one who had the love affair with Ronald Reagan, who penned the title of her memoirs with her immortal admonition to the first President Bush that it was no time to go wobbly. A great title for a chapter, isn't it? Over Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, even Mrs. Key was ready to criticize our liberation of Grenada. And that came right in the aftermath of the support that we gave them for the Falklands War. Well, does that mean that, as they say, there are no allies only, alliances only interests? No, not really. It's a false distinction. All states have interests. And when their interests converge often enough, they're going to form alliances. But it's rare for interests to converge all of the time over years and decades. When some aspects of the interests diverge, the ties that bind alliances are certainly likely to fray. But they're not going to come apart if underlying commonalities remain intact. And Europe provides the best truism about alliances, which I know would gladden the heart of Robert. How many years is it since we've been talking about the rise of Asian economic power? How many years is it since we've been talking about the influence of non-Anglo-Saxon, non-European communities in the United States, and how that's going to shift our view away from the Atlantic and diminish the importance of our European alliances? They keep saying it's going to happen soon. But soon seems to be a rolling term, because it hasn't happened yet. And I don't think it's going to materialize for some time. First of all, to quote my former boss, Don Rumsfeld, there's a new Europe as well as an old Europe. A new Europe, by which the Secretary of Defense means democracies that emerged from the Soviet shadow and have joined NATO, has a fundamental strategic interest in cleaving to the United States. I mean, literally, not letting any daylight between them and us. And that interest is not going to go away for the foreseeable future, because for the first time ever in their histories, the small states that are sandwiched between Russia and Germany have a reliable ally that's going to come to their aid, unlike the British and the French, who didn't exactly help the Poles out in 1939 in the way the Poles had hoped for, much less the Czechs. But there are other Europes that have every incentive to remain close to the United States as well. Let's look at old Europe. That's not a monolith. Old Europe includes the Brits, the Italians, the Portuguese, the Danes, the Norwegians, and others. They supported us and continue to support us in Iraq, whether it's with votes in NATO, whether it's troops, whether it's financial contributions, or even when it functioned, the late lamented Coalition Provisional Authority had personnel from all of these places. Then there's another Europe. Southeastern Europe. These are states like Romania and Bulgaria that are not NATO members, but they want to join NATO. Not only that, they want to house American troops on their territory. I had ministers in these countries coming to me because I was the money guy, talking to me about, well, you know, how much money would save us if we put our troops in country X or country Y in Southeastern Europe. Same reason. We are their bulwark against big neighbors. Geography's not going to change that. They're with us. They have made a strategic turn that they simply will not go back on. So what about the recalcitrants, the French and the British, and the Germans, rather? Well, when I visited Afghanistan, and I did that a number of times, I spoke with French trainers who work alongside our forces developing a viable Afghan National Army. I also stayed with a German provincial reconstruction team in Kunduz. Now think about it. Germans in Afghanistan. Yeah, this isn't Raiders of the Lost Ark. This is real stuff. This is real Germans dealing with real problems, with real tribesmen as part of an organized force to bring democracy to that country. Then there's the much criticized NATO International Force. It's represented not only by all NATO members, but a lot of other Europeans besides. They're in Kabul. And then what about Spain, you know, the country that turned on a dime and left us? Well, just the fact that they disagree with us on NATO, on Iraq policy, doesn't make them less of an ally. They're still in Afghanistan. And they've done something that they had never done before, and they're not taking that back, which is work for the first time in decades, working alongside us in Latin America, which confounds those people who hate gringos and look to Spain for leadership. And I saw that firsthand, because I went down to Latin America, both Central America and South America, with my Spanish counterpart, Deputy Minister of Defense, to brief them about sending troops to Iraq. The briefings were in Spanish. Thank God there was Castilian Spanish, which is close enough to French, because I don't understand any Central American or South American Spanish, although South American said their Spanish is as pure as Castilian. Well, maybe. Point is, it was the Spanish that took the lead. And we briefed legislators who were opposed to the idea of sending troops. But because the Spanish briefed them, it changed the way they looked at the problem. And we did get four countries to send troops. Now, three of those countries have left because Spain left. But El Salvador is still there. And there are many others. And frankly, whether a country has 10 troops or 10,000 troops, every death, every war wound is going to be felt by a mother, a sister, a brother, a husband. Now, I'm not naive. A lot of countries join the coalition because they expected some economic benefit from doing so. And when I was under Secretary of Defense, I had a lot of visits from ministers and ambassadors. They wanted contracts, or at least subcontracts, for their domestic companies, essentially saying in a not too subtle way that they were going to exchange their participation in some way in Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom, for some kind of contract. I was even approached by states that would only send troops if we covered all their expenses, not just the expense of getting to the theater, but their personnel costs. And some even wanted UN rates. And you may know that the UN rates are very, very high, so that defense ministries benefit from the additional money that is paid to troops who are paid at much lower salary rates. But frankly, these kinds of so-called offers to help are just part of the calculus that enters into every government's decision whether or not to join a military conflict. Democracies have a complex calculus. They ignore public opinion at their peril. I mean, it's all very nice to tell the leaders of a democratic nation to defy their publics, or to defy their legislatures, or to do both. But if they do so long enough, they're not going to be leaders anymore. So they have to calculate how far they can go. And let me go back to those economically based offers. We did reject requests to pay UN rates. There's one country that insisted on it. The Joint Staff was convinced that they would join up with us, and when they heard that I was saying no, they said, then we'll go. And we said, goodbye. We did not accept that kind of offer. We didn't even cover the cost of personnel or the cost of insurance, which is something else people asked for. Nevertheless, dozens of states offered troops to the coalition. Dozens worked under Jerry Bremer in the Coalition Provisional Authority. Dozens contributed funds, and funds that have materialized as schools, as training centers, as hospitals in Iraq. the Mongolians protected the Hungarians when they came under fire. The Hungarian ambassador said to me the last time they had any dealings with the Mongolians, it wasn't very pleasant. Genghis Khan was there all alive, you know. I mean, this was a true coalition. Still is. My last visit to Iraq, I met with Japanese troops. The last place you expect to meet Japanese troops. Not in Samarra. There they were. The Jordanians have provided trainers. The Emirates have provided hospitals and water purification equipment. And I can go on and on. That stuff doesn't make the headlines. Part of the difficulty we have is that we as Americans might discuss alliances in the abstract, but we're actually pretty oblivious about the particulars. Our oldest allies are the Dutch, the Moroccans, and the French. Hardly an American who would classify them as our closest allies today. Probably hardly an American who would know about two out of the three. Among our steadiest allies, over the years, certainly since World War II, have been the Portuguese. Who thinks about the Portuguese? You think about port, but not the Portuguese. I think very few people can list more than five allies who've contributed personnel and material either to Iraq or to Afghanistan. So what makes alliances tick? I can't speak for all alliances. But common interests are obviously the basis of them all. From the days of ancient Greece's Delian and Peloponnesian leagues, onward throughout the centuries. And enduring common interests allow for something more than coalitions of the willing. You know, that's the term where you have this ad hoc alliance is sort of like pick up sandlot ball, or, you know, whoever shows up, shows up. This is something more than just coalitions of the willing. If you have enduring common interests, that will ameliorate periodic disputes. That's what the NATO alliance has shown over the decades. That's what Robert Strauss and Pei had in mind. Now, what are enduring common interests? Fascinating question. Because political culture may be the most important of these, but by itself it's not going to determine alliances. All members of NATO are democracies, but not all democracies are members of NATO. In fact, not all members of NATO have been democracies. Nor, for that matter, have all members of the Rio Pact been democracies. In fact, there was a time when most of them weren't. The Rio Pact, of course, is our agreement with all our Latin American neighbors. So the political culture is an element, but doesn't explain it. Now, what about a common cultural heritage? Well, there are major exceptions. If by common cultural heritage we mean that of Europe, which is the origin of the majority of our citizens, then we certainly don't share a common cultural heritage with Turkey. That was, again, something Robert fought very strongly against, that sort of narrow-minded notion of what common cultural heritage was about. What, for that matter, with Japan? Or with South Korea, or with some of those Arab major non-NATO allies like Jordan and Morocco. Hard to call those democracies either. So what do we share in common with all our allies? It's basically a desire for stability and a determination to prevent aggression by one state against another. And more recently, aggression by terrorist groups against innocent populations. And even in this case, there have been exceptions. Argentina was an ally when it launched the Falklands War. So clearly that was not a country that was interested in stability at the time. And as a result, it created a major schism inside our government, at least initially, between those who felt that it was very important to remain close to Argentina and those who were outraged by what Argentina had done. But that's really an exception. In general, the desire to maintain a peaceful and stable international system within which people can move and trade relatively freely and securely does unite us with our allies and certainly separates us from our adversaries. Now, when you take this common desire and couple it with some combination of either political commonalities or cultural commonalities or historical ties or mutual economic interests, then the ties that bind our alliances, in my view at least, remain fundamentally healthy. So, back to the beginning. Is Mr. Kerry right? Are our alliances crumbling? I would say not if you visit Afghanistan. Not if you visit NATO headquarters. Not if you go down to Tampa at Central Command headquarters and see the dozens of military liaison officers in states around the world that are down there. Not if you visit our joint command in Korea. Not if you visit our joint headquarters in Japan. Not if you visit the headquarters of the many foreign commands that are still in Iraq. It's probably worth noting that a very, very astute observer of the most special of our relationships, and that, of course, is the British one. And this is a Brit, a journalist named Jeffrey Smith, wrote in a book that was about Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, and I'm quoting here, "It's hard to believe that there will ever again be an American president and a British prime minister who will form quite as close a personal association." But in fact, Tony Blair managed to do just about that. And he did it with two such similar personalities as Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. What that tells us is that you really have to be careful about predicting that somehow alliances or alliance relationships have peaked and it's all downhill from here. It's just not that way. If the fundamentals are sound, you're going to see a constant recrudescence of those relationships. So, what makes alliances tick? I kind of think our alliance ticker is pretty healthy. And, yeah, Iraq may represent a little bit of a murmur to keep the ticker analogy going. But nevertheless, the heartbeat of our alliances is quite sound. And I predict, at least, that it'll remain sound and healthy for many years to come. Thank you.
Take questions from the audience. There is a microphone there, and I would ask you to line up.
That's not as opposed to Republican, though. Well, again, if you go back to the precedent of Vietnam, Europe was clearly not with us on Vietnam. But the NATO alliance held. Now, you might say, well, you know, we have the threat of the Cold War, we have the threat of the Soviets, but we have the threat of terrorism. And that's really my point about Afghanistan. Even as the French call us the hyperpower and go after us at every possible occasion, nevertheless, they haven't pulled any trainers out of Afghanistan. They have people in Haiti. It basically comes down to, in my view, the fact that Iraq is, at least in alliance terms, an aberration. It's an irritant. We don't know where our allies will go on this, but frankly, I'm not sure we know where we will go. So why expect more of the allies than we expect of ourselves? I mean, pick up the newspapers every day, forget Republican, Democratic, just look at the different analysts. Everybody's got a different solution as to what to do next. Well, if you're an ally and you have public opinion not exactly thrilled with your support, I'm saying if you're a government of an ally, of course you're going to be confused at this stage. And until we outline very clearly what we're going to do next, and I suspect that will only happen after the two elections, actually, the one here and the one in Iraq, you'll have this kind of sense of instability. But however that comes out, I think the alliances have enough glue in them for the reasons that I gave And there is enough evidence out there today. No one has pulled out of NATO. No one has pulled out of Afghanistan. That in and of itself should tell you that they're fundamentally, fundamentally sound. Now, the UN isn't irrelevant. It doesn't particularly help alliances. It doesn't particularly hurt alliances. That doesn't make it irrelevant. It's not, that is not what the UN is for. We work with the UN. We're working with the UN in Southeast Europe. We're working with alongside the UN in Afghanistan. We'd like to work alongside the UN in Iraq. That's more the UN's problem than ours. Although some would say it was our problem earlier on, but nevertheless, here and now, we clearly like to work alongside them. I don't think the UN is irrelevant. And frankly, if the French think it's so irrelevant, they ought to give up their seat on the Security Council to the Germans or the Indians. I don't see them doing that. It's not irrelevant, but it is not the creator of alliances. It's a very, very different category of kettle of fish, if you will.
We used to have an old diplomatic rule of thumb that seems to have been forgotten. That is that you have to bring your alliance to the UN. If you go to the UN looking for one, you'll never find it. Murray, if you get to the mic over there. Okay.
Okay. The question, for those of you who may not have heard it, was, can I give some perspectives on our, as the questioner put it, our adventure in Iraq? Look, I think it's pretty clear that we made some mistakes. I'm not saying mistakes were made. I'm saying we made mistakes. There's no doubt about it. I think part of it is that our system was not geared to supporting the kind of solution that we wanted to materialize there. Now, what do I mean by that? We basically made a choice that we would not go with a military governor like MacArthur was, or like Lucius Clay was, Germany, Japan, and Germany, but rather go with a civilian leadership, first former General Garner, and then with Jerry Bremer, Ambassador Bremer. But we didn't give Jerry the wherewithal to do his job. And the reason I say that, and I had some personal experience with people on my staff, we could not force anyone in the civil service to go to Iraq. Now, if you're military, you get an order, you go. If you're foreign service, the system has all sorts of emoluments, benefits, incentives to go. But civil servants can refuse. And then they'll go to the Merit Protection Board or whatever, and the thing will take 2 years, or civil service unions will get involved, and, you know, by the time they're done, you know, you're not even in Iraq anymore. What that meant was that Jerry Bremer did not have the benefit of middle management. He did not have the people, in civil service terms, the GS-15s, or the senior executive service people, anything like the numbers he needed. What he therefore had to rely on was a cadre of very, very senior people, many of whom are retired, who obviously weren't going to do the grunt work, and a bunch of kids, people in their, you know, people my kid's age, in their 20s. Now, with the greatest of respect to every one of those 20-somethings, putting them in charge of a country, not a dictatorship, you could be a dictator at 20, but putting them in charge of that situation was asking too much. That forced Jerry Bremer into an impossible choice. He either could spend his time doing what he really needed to do, which was to engage governments at high levels, to engage the Sistanis of this world, or to micromanage the kids. Well, he realized if he didn't micromanage the kids, nothing would happen. But by micromanaging the kids, he didn't do what he needed to do. And so, things just didn't work out. The system let him down. So that's my fundamental perspective on it. Now, what has happened since? He brought in an American embassy with a top diplomat, John Negroponte. By the way, has no ambitions whatsoever. He had a great job in New York City, and you know, he was called back in, and he was doing his duty. He was called upon. He's got a good staff. You have now in the National Security Council in particular a very, very able go-getter named Robert Blackwell. You want to get from A to B, Bob will get you there. You have a very able set of generals in Iraq, beginning with John Abizay, but also George Casey. And further down at the three-star level and so on. So you have a nucleus of a good team, but most important of all, we're moving toward a situation where we're giving power to Alawi. The more we do that, the more optimistic I am. Does that mean that things will work out beautifully? Oh, no. Not at all. I can't say that. I can't allege that. But I think we're pointing in the right direction. The question is, do we have enough time? And that I can't answer. Well, on the Turkish issue, I mean, the Turks have...
Wait a second.
You didn't hear the question. The question was basically, you know, what about the Europeans in Turkey? And related to that, whether the Europeans were cutting off their noses to spite their faces by rejecting requests to be more involved in Iraq, when, after all, if Turkey joins Europe, Iraq is now in Europe's borders. The Europeans have, I think the first time the Europeans discussed some sort of membership of Turkey in the then European Economic Community was 1962. And I believe it was then they signed an association agreement with the Turks, and the idea was that, you know, within 5 or 7 years, Turkey would become a member. So 62, it's a couple years ago. The Beatles were still not yet created. Want to measure history that way. And here's Turkey, still trying to get in, still knocking on the door, with sore knuckles, and knocking for 30 years, 40 years. Europeans are ambivalent about the Turks. They're ambivalent for cultural reasons, but they're also ambivalent, which should be obvious to everybody, also ambivalent for economic reasons. Turkey would be the biggest country in Europe. It is not a wealthy country. The Western Europeans are already having trouble absorbing East Germany and absorbing Poland and absorbing all these other states that are fundamentally still heavily agricultural. And the fear is you bring Turkey in, the whole house of cards comes back. Now, one could ask, you let the Poles in, you let the Czechs, you let the Hungarians, you let the Romanians, you let the Bulgarians, so why the Turks? And that brings you back to the cultural reason. So there is this fundamental ambivalence. We support Turkish membership in the European Union because we believe that that will create a stronger union, and it won't leave the Turks feeling that they're hanging out there. Because if the Turks feel they're hanging out there and they have any kind of disagreement with us, the Turks have phenomenally long memories. They still talk about a thing called the Johnson Letter. And by that, they mean Lyndon Johnson, but it's so long ago, it could have been Andrew Johnson. And what they're talking about is a letter that was sent to admonish them over Cyprus. Now, Lyndon Johnson has not been president for a while, and they're still talking about it. So if the Turks get a sufficient sense of isolation, and we know right now they have an Islamic government, couldn't it be possible that the Turks just walk and do what at least one-third of the country doesn't want to do, which is join the Islamic world? having them part of the EU helps in that regard. So we're all for it. Now, in terms of the Europeans participating in Iraq or not, again, I mean, when we say which, you know, which Europeans, we're talking about the French and the Germans. That is not the be-all and end-all of Europe. That was part of what I was trying to say. And believe you me, if an Hungarian kid is killed, as they have been, or Italian, as they have been, or Brit, as so many have been, they're Europeans too. By the way, many of these countries that are in Iraq are still ambivalent about Turkey. So, it's far more complex than that. And I really don't know which way Europe will go on Turkey. If they're smart, they'll figure out a way to absorb the Turks into Europe. It is in their interest to do so. But that's for them to decide.
Yes, sir.
Why talk about Iraq? I mean, we lost the war in Vietnam. Out and out lost it. That didn't destroy our alliances. Our alliances are there because there's a common interest in preserving certain values or just territorial integrity or a way of life. And the fact that we're having difficulties in Iraq, and I certainly won't deny it, does not mean that that necessarily undermines our alliances. Now, I don't know, as I said, where we will go or where Iraq will go after January when a new president or the same president, a new administration will be sworn in and a new Iraqi president will be sworn in. I don't know where that will lead. But one thing I can tell you, if we managed to get past Vietnam, I think we can manage to get past Iraq. Pointed to the various things that make it very difficult. The one advantage that somebody from the United States has is our power, is the fact that in the case of many, many countries, we did come to their assistance in the past, is also the fact that most people like Americans. They may not like our policy. They may not like our president, whoever the president is, but they like Americans. And that is a tremendous plus. I can think of several countries that I will not name that are not liked, whether it's business or government. People say, I don't like negotiating with these people. How can you generalize about an entire country? Guess what? We do. Everybody does. When it comes to Americans, most people do like us. The same polls in the Arab world that have the worst things to say about our policies also say that they like Americans. And during the Cold War, it was pretty obvious we didn't have too many emigrants to the Soviet Union. They were all coming in this direction, regardless of what policies we had. That is a tremendous natural advantage for us. And then it's a question of building on. That's why sometimes it's economics. Sometimes it's helping a country because they want to help, but they feel, well, they can't afford to. And it's important to them to show they're participating. In Eastern Europe, that's the case. That's part of their way of demonstrating they're our allies. They're doing that for their reasons. Poland doesn't want to ever be invaded again or divided. I mean, this is a country that was twice partitioned. So for them, it's in their interest to be able to show they can help. And then they don't have the money. So they come to us and say, well, okay, can you help us out to some extent, which we did. So you deal with the different motives, you deal with the different interests, recognizing those two things. One, we have a lot to offer, and we've basically been a good ally. And two, people tend to like us. That's kind of nice. Saying we don't have enough troops. We've got 140,000 troops there, and people say we don't have enough. But we've got a population of, what, 300 million, give or take? What about the Lithuanians that have 3 million people? So their 300 troops is like, what, 10,000? We've got to look at that in relative terms as well. So that it's not merely the fact that any individual who's killed is just as dead as any other individual. It's also relative to the population, relative to the gross domestic product, relative to the impact on what would happen if you sent large numbers of troops to Iraq. It's different for different countries. You give reasons that are very effective. There are more. I mean, it's not just having Muslim populations. It's not just fear of terrorism. The press, the European intelligentsia, which historically has always liked to throw mud at the United States, even as they come to our watering holes and pontificate here, is just doing what it's always done. I mean, you can go back to Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre and all those kinds of folks. This has been going on since 1945. As soon as we liberated them, they started criticizing us. So that's nothing new. So there's, in addition to a palpable uncertainty as to what to do about Muslim populations, in addition to a fear of terrorism, although, you know, let's temper that a little bit. We did have the case in Spain, but, you know, the Brits are hanging in there. And they've had IRA terrorists for a long time, and now they have IRA potential terrorists and potential Muslim terrorists. So they're not all cowards, by any stretch of the imagination, but you do have that as well. And when I say the intelligentsia, I just don't mean the college professors. I mean the media. And the media is extremely powerful. You can take the most critical American cable channel and hold it up against the BBC and our cable channel looks like the rah-rah of President Bush. That's how critical the opinions are. Pick up El País, pick up Le Monde, or some of the German papers, so that you have that as well. That in and of itself, though, I don't think will necessarily mean that the alliances will get undermined for the same reason that, you know, they're always demonstrating in South Korea against the United States. But look at the reaction when we said we would move troops out. As long as they know we're there, they're demonstrating. As soon as they're afraid we're going to go, look at the German reaction. Secretary Rumsfeld said we're pulling troops out of Germany over the next 10 years. the reaction's been uniformly negative. The same people that don't want to work with us in Iraq, that have criticized us, they don't want to lose one soldier. I want to tell you something. Well, I think the first thing about dealing with China is recognizing that you're not dealing with your classic adversary. You're not. For a start, the Chinese tend not to invade people. They like to have people give them fealty of one kind or another through their influence, through their pervasiveness, through their perhaps threat of power. So you're not going to get a Saddam Hussein who crosses into Kuwait place out. That's number one. Number two is China is a country that fundamentally is still an empire. You have about 90% Han Chinese, and at least 10% of the others. That's about 130 million people. That's a lot of people. So it's an empire. And the Han Chinese, of course, are concerned first and foremost about keeping the empire stable. That plays both ways. In the case of China, it tends to mean that you can get through to them when they see that their stability might be threatened. That's why we can work with them on Korea, because the last thing they want is for their own Koreans to kick up trouble, not so much because of the 3 million Koreans in China, but because of all those other people, the Uyghurs and out in Xinjiang and all the rest. That's another factor. The third factor is that, you know, is China going to stay the way it is today? That isn't guaranteed. No. It is a country that is continually evolving. You know, the more free enterprise takes hold of China, the better the betting that somehow it's going to move to democracy. Because if you look at Spain, where for years Franco tolerated free enterprise, or Portugal, or even South Africa, which took a century, you see that ultimately, if you have a country that's rooted in free enterprise, the middle classes, the heart of free enterprise, are not going to be comfortable being stifled politically. So this is a country that is undergoing an evolution at the same time as it has every interest in stability, at the same time as it has never really demonstrated aggression, and I'll leave Taiwan aside and come back to it in a second, against other countries. There's Tibet, but again, they believe Tibet is historically part of China. And they believe Taiwan is historically part of China. And of course, the Taiwanese being Chinese, they're just as patient as the mainlanders. So the Taiwanese say, well, eventually China's going to become a democracy and then everything will be fine. Either if you believe in an independent Taiwan, they say, we'll be independent and nobody will care. Or if you believe they'll eventually get together, they'll get together as a democracy. And then you have the other side, the Beijing side, which says we've got patience, we'll eventually wait out the Taiwanese. But that's good. Let them have patience. As long as they don't cause a war with one another for 1,000 years, that's pretty good.
Thank you very much for that terrific lecture. I'm sure we're all coming away with wise. And I also want to thank you all for turning out for the Robert Strauss-Pay lecture, and we look forward to seeing you again next year. Turn.